This is a special episode of Top of Mind, marking Labor Day. It's great to have you with us. First this hour, Americans are working more and more hours. Is it time for another labor revolution in this country? Then, a look at the rise of digital nomads who take remote working to extreme lengths. And how America's biggest labor unions became some of the country's biggest advocates for immigrant rights. That's ahead on Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose.
And I'm Ciara Hewlett. At the height of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s, Americans rose up to fight horrible working conditions and extremely long work hours. Labor Day is the celebration of their success. But ironically, today, we work just as much, if not more than they did. Working hours on average have increased by 13% since the 70s. That's about 5 extra weeks of work per year. And we work more than our peer countries. What's going on? Sociologist Jamie McCallum calls this labor's forgotten fight. He's author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream, and teaches at Middlebury College. He joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You write in your book that whoever controls labor in any society also controls time. If American workers have lost control of their work time and put in more hours now, do you think Labor Day still holds any meaning?
Yeah, well, Labor Day is a sort of twisted version of May Day, the original Labor Day, which actually was inaugurated first in the United States, but is almost never celebrated here. And so Labor Day is sort of a time, you know, you think of like barbecues and whatever else you do with your time, you know, that day, which is fine. But it's rarely a time to really reflect on the kind of state of the American workforce. It is the case, however, that the labor movement are, as the bumper sticker says, are the people who brought you the weekend. And so for that reason, I think it's worth it. It's definitely relevant. It's definitely should be front and center in our minds that day, that it was people who fought for control over those days and those hours. That is why we have the right to rest whenever we do, even if it's less these days than it was 40 or 50 years ago. So I think that the holiday is relevant. I do think it would be great if Americans pay a little bit more attention to some of the sacrifices and risks that people took so that we had those, so that we had that holiday.
What changed that we began to start working so much more? Why we had that revolution, and there's some really interesting pictures in your book of even women marching down the street with signs that saying, you know, 6-hour day, 8 hours pay, keep depression away.
Right.
We definitely don't have a 6-hour day today. So what happened?
A few things happened. So the first one, there was a time in the probably the 40s when, as the hours of labor were steadily declining, people realized that they had time to do stuff, you know, and leisure is expensive. And so there was a moment of reaction where people were like, okay, actually, in order to take my family on vacation or go here or go there, I actually have to earn a little bit more to pay for it.
Oh.
Like there was, you know, like organized leisure costs money. And so therefore, there was a tendency to work a little longer to save up more money, take an extra shift here and there to pay for the vacation. But since that time, from the 40s on to the 70s, the hours of labor on aggregate nonetheless declined. The real transformation was in the 70s when, I mean, the best word to describe it, even though it's not really the common one, is just class war. And that is that when the American business class began attacking the fortunes and organizations of the American working class, one of the first things to go was unions and high wages. In order to make up for the lost wages over the last 40 or 50 years, we've largely worked longer.
Mm.
So basically, you could say that massive inequality and the sort of increased domination of corporate America force wages down. And to make up the difference, we've worked more. Today, a lot of low-wage workers simply can't afford to work less.
But other countries, our peer countries like European countries, they haven't done the same thing. They're actually decreasing in time that they're working, and we work more than they do now. So what's the difference there?
Yeah. I mean, from a social science perspective, we have what's called a natural experiment, whereby we all work the same in 1960 something. You know, France, Germany, the UK, Canada, the United States, there was a lot of parity. And now we've gone in different directions. And to some extent, a lot of that is typically explained by some sort of cultural argument about, oh, Americans just like hard work and we have a Protestant ethic. And that's not, there's a lot of Protestants in Europe. You know, that's not exactly the difference. I think the difference is that we have managed to create an incredibly large, disproportionately large, low-wage working class. And those are the people who've increased their hours the most over the last couple decades. And so we have more of them, and therefore we work longer hours. There is other explanations. I mean, Europe and Canada have stronger trade union federations that allow workers to have more control over when they work and when they don't. And there are generally more holidays and more time for paid time off, sick leave, parental leave, sabbaticals, vacation time. They all have more of that, which basically decreases your level of annual hours. So I would say it's a combination of those factors.
Is there something to be said, though, for Americans just working harder? That, I mean, we have this deep seated belief in the American dream, right? And that if you just work harder, then you will succeed and you will get ahead. Could that be part of why we work more? Is just that we do have that just kind of in our roots, though, that we believe in that American dream.
The American dream is certainly part of the national creed. However, hard work pays off more in European countries than it does in America.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean that hard work pays off more in European countries?
Well, I mean, like, there's, if you think of the American dream as intergenerational mobility or climbing an economic ladder, economic mobility, that's not the story of America anymore. It was sort of around mid-century, but it's not been for a long time. And in some Western European countries, there's a lot of intergenerational mobility. In other words, like, I'm 44. My generation is the last one in America whose economic prospects are going to be better than my parents. Millennials and Gen X are worse off. And so we're sort of going the other way. So when I say hard work doesn't pay off, I mean, like, our hours are increasing, our wages are not, and our savings are not. And so we have this creed, they have this idea of the American dream that, you know, work hard and get ahead. There's not anymore a lot of data to back it up that's actually what's going on.
Do you think people still believe it, though, and so they still try to work harder, work more hours?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, I think that there are... So if you look at public opinion polls, most generations think that the generation after them is lazy. Hmm. But that always... Like, the next generation can't just be continually lazier, right? That seems unlikely. So there is, like, a belief in the idea that, well, you know, I work hard and, you know, I deserve X, Y, and Z. So there may be that belief at a certain level, but I'd imagine that if you talk to steelworkers from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and steelworkers from, south of Munich in Germany, a lot of them agree that hard work is important. Like, you know, it's not a particularly, especially American belief. It's just historically disjoined, or there's a disjuncture from that belief and the sort of reality. the way it does function, the American dream might function, is to think about the way work like means something to us, that we have a kind of like cultural and psychological attachment to the importance of work to our you know, conception of ourselves. And that is a little bit more pronounced in the United States.
I'm speaking with Jamie McCallum. He's author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream. And he's a sociologist at Middlebury College. Do you think, though, that the fact that we work more in the United States benefits other countries? Is, you know, maybe it's bad for us, but it's benefiting the world that, you know, we come up with a lot of innovation and we give the world Apple and the Amazon and things like that.
I guess my short answer to that is no. Like a overworked and underemployed large working class in the United States sort of superficially benefits other places, I guess, in the short term. But in fact, like, our poor working conditions in general in the United States tends to drag down working conditions elsewhere. Like, American employers who operate in Europe operate better there. But like in Europe, Amazon is a better job. McDonald's is a better job. And so, but what we do, what the American economy gives those places is an excuse once in a while to say, hey, look, you know, we pay Americans $8 an hour. We're not going to pay you 25. And so in that sense, we have, our economy has a tendency to drag others down. As far as innovation, it's true that we have a lot of companies in America that have developed the kinds of technologies and industries which are important to the world. But for example, the Chinese delivery and sort of online shopping situation is years ahead of ours, like 5 or 6 years ahead of ours. During the pandemic, they had no problem supplying delivery drivers for decent wages for what people needed. And here we had a, we actually early on had a slight difficulty. So I don't think the sort of innovative techno sort of world is also is uniquely American.
And why is it important that we work less, that we have more free time and you know, work a normal 40-hour work week or less?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is that people seem to want to. Like, public opinion polls routinely show that one of the reasons, especially low-wage workers, work more hours is because they have to, either because they are paying the rent is too high, or they're just going to work to get employer-paid health care to qualify, or for whatever reason. High-income earners tend to, who have much higher levels of job satisfaction, also tend to be stressed out with 60 and 70-hour weeks. So I think there's a basic feeling among a lot of Americans that we would like to work less. Two is that in some ways the pandemic has been an interesting, again, a natural experiment, because hours did go up in the beginning, but then they shrunk down. And it does appear that we can be productive in a shorter amount of time. And so why this necessity of this magical 40-hour week when it's clear we can produce a lot at 30 hours, let's say, or 34 hours? I mean, the economies around the world that are our peer countries who work fewer hours, they're not exactly starving in the streets. Like, they have what they need to have a healthy society. And we work more to produce not a comparably better standard of living. And I think that bargain just isn't worth it anymore.
So what's the solution? Do we need a new labor revolution that, you know, down the road in the future, that's what we'll be celebrating on Labor Day and fight for, you know, a 30-hour work week or whatever it is? What do we do here?
Yeah, gosh, I mean, that would be great if Labor Day was we were celebrating that. But I think in the meantime, you know, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, regardless of where you, of what your occupation is, there's a general feeling among Americans, according to surveys and polls, that they have not enough power at work. And so what are the kinds of things that would get them the kind of power that they want? For example, passing widespread sweeping labor law reform that basically is the form of the PRO Act called the Protect the Right to Organize Act, which would be the first major labor law reform since the New Deal 75 years ago. That's a pretty big deal. There's a slim chance it will pass, but those are the kinds of imaginative and innovative policy proposals that we should be looking into.
And that would put, as we talked at the beginning of our conversation, put the control of time back in the hands of the workers.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of provisions in those laws which allow people time for sick leave and paid time off and greater negotiating power when it comes to healthcare. You know, if you have to bargain with your employer over healthcare, then you can't bargain over hours and wages. If we pass universal healthcare legislation and you take that off the table, then you can bargain over wages and hours. So you're all of a sudden at an increased advantage. And those kinds of reforms have sort of spillover effects to the way we think about our working time and our working hours.
Jamie McCallum is author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream, and he is a professor of sociology at Middlebury College. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
Coming up in about 15 minutes on this special Labor Day episode, how America's biggest labor unions became some of the country's biggest advocates for immigrant rights. Just ahead, a look at the rise of digital nomads. You along for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Work life may never be the same for many people after the pandemic. More jobs are possible to do remotely than most employers thought. Now companies are under pressure from employees who'd like to keep working remotely, in some cases from a completely different state or country. The ranks of digital nomads, as they're called, exploded in 2020, just as sociologist Rachel Waldoff and management expert Robert Litchfield were finishing the research for a new book, which included spending months living among a community of digital nomads in Bali, Indonesia. Waldoff is a professor at West Virginia University, and Litchfield is a professor at Washington and Jefferson College, and they are both with me now. Hi, welcome. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
So when I hear that there's a community of workers in Bali, that makes me think we're talking about those Instagram influencer types who actually make a living sitting on a beach and taking pretty pictures somewhere. Is that primarily who these digital nomads are and what they do for a living, Professor Waldoff?
I would say no, not based on what we saw. Of course, you think of that as who digital nomads are because that's who's on Instagram, right? Doing those pictures at the pool and bragging about their lifestyle. But most of the people who live this way are just working in co-working spaces, doing all kinds of freelance jobs. Some of them are actually pretty quiet jobs like writing or coding. Yeah, they sometimes will post on Instagram to their friends, but in general, they're not influencers.
How did they convince their bosses to let them live in a completely different country on the other side of the planet from the United States, Professor Litchfield?
Well, some of them did and some of them didn't. There are kind of three groups of people who we studied. The largest numerically are freelancers. And so these are people who, many of whom quit their jobs specifically so that they could go out and do this. They decided that the corporate life wasn't right for them. And they, you know, so a typical person in our sample is someone, and we had 18 countries represented. So there's people from a variety of different backgrounds. But the typical person in our sample is someone who's in their early to mid 30s. They went to college, and they came out and got the jobs that you're supposed to want. the kind of high-end knowledge work jobs in technology or marketing or journalism and media in a top-tier creative class city. So maybe they're working in New York or London or San Francisco or Sydney, Australia or Paris, one of these kinds of places. And these are very work-identified people. They went out, they got that job, they started to work, and they were excited. And they put their head down and they worked. And sometime around 8 to 10 years later, for a lot of them, they realized all of a sudden or over time that, hey, you know what? This isn't what I thought it was going to be. And actually, I'm not enjoying this at all. And I feel like this career path is no longer very satisfying. And there are a number of reasons for this. That creative class work is maybe not as creative as they thought it was going to be. The organization structure is maybe a little too restrictive, and the culture is maybe not what they wanted. And they're being forced into a heavy regime of FaceTime that's cutting down their chances to enjoy life in the city. And it's pretty expensive anyways. And so, you know, the average person in our sample was probably making like a low six-figure salary, but they're making that money in London or in Paris or in New York. It doesn't go very far. And so these are the people who decided, hey, look, you know, this isn't working for me. And these freelance, they decided to go into freelance work from that. Mm. Now, of course, there are also people who are remote workers. And these are the people who, I guess, you know, were really top of mind right now. People who do have a salary job who managed to be able to work remotely, either because they've negotiated it with their boss or because, you know, the job was always specced that way in a minority of cases. Mm. And then the third group were people who are entrepreneurs and who are working in online entrepreneurship.
And all of this predated the pandemic.
The pandemic has just accelerated or you know, brought into focus what millennials have been trying to say, which is they want more freedom at work. And they don't like the very outdated boundaries of FaceTime, literal FaceTime in the office, where you're just in a very corporatized role. And the only time you're able to travel is on your 2-week vacation.
I mean, are they actually traveling a lot? Because it sounded to me like from reading the, you know, some of the accounts in your research that a lot of them just sort of stay put in Bali. So what's the point of that? Like, how does that scratch the itch that they felt like they needed to scratch when they kind of pulled up roots, Professor Woldoff?
I mean, so Bali serves several purposes. It's much cheaper to live in Bali than in the U.S. in terms of housing, food, services. So you're making Western dollars and spending them down in an economy that's very different from ours. And so that's one of the reasons to go to a place like Bali or to go to Chiang Mai, Thailand. And then, yes, they do base themselves in Bali, but they're free to also travel. So they'll be based in Bali, but they'll be planning trips. And one of the benefits of Bali over, let's say, I live in Pittsburgh, living in Pittsburgh, is you're not just going to Starbucks to work and sitting with your headphones on. You're meeting with, and this is a huge focus of our book, is the importance of place and having like-minded people there. So if you're somebody who is interested in recreating your career and changing it and shifting it, if you're somebody that's interested in freedom and you don't really like the office culture and the FaceTime culture and sitting by the proverbial water cooler talking about sports, if you're somebody who's really interested in personal development, like so many of our new nomads are, how are you going to find like-minded others to support you in the very, you know, difficult work that comes with working outside of the box and creating your own story about your work portfolio and how you're going to earn money? Well, Bali provides that because they have these co-working spaces there designed not just to sit there with headphones on and then get back home to your wife and kids or your husband and kids or whoever's at home. It's designed for you to interact with the people there and help each other on their journey and motivate each other. And so it's very different from like a WeWork or a Starbucks that we have here, mm-hmm. which are basically just kind of like rented office spaces.
Professor Litchfield, do a lot of people bring families with them into this remote working type situation?
Okay, so most of the people who we met and interviewed are traveling solo. They are singles. The average age in our sample, the mean age was like around 32. That's why these communities also are so important and valuable to them. We did meet families. So the myth is, of course, also that these people are, you know, sort of trust funders or whatever, and that they've got tons and tons of resources behind them. But we didn't find that to be the case. They do have resources in the sense of their skills, right? So these are people who can work online, who have knowledge work skills. On the other hand, most of them didn't enter into the lifestyle with tremendous wealth. That's a little different for families, though. So we did meet families also and interview some families for our project. They tended on the whole to be better off. And in fact, a more typical path for a family was one where they were, say, already running a successful business in whatever country they came from, and then they realized that they could probably run that business from anywhere, and they decided to start doing that.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Robert Litchfield, who's a professor of business at Washington and Jefferson College, and Rachel Waldoff, a professor of sociology at West Virginia University. Together, they are authors of Digital Nomads: In Search of Freedom, Community, and Meaningful Work in the New Economy. Professor Litchfield, you mentioned that a lot of people embark, especially the sort of in their 30s, 8 to 10 years into their careers, creative class type workers who embark on this lifestyle are burned out. Do they end up working less when they become digital nomads, or are they just working the same hours? They just feel better about it because they're in Bali.
Now, this is where you see a lot of variance. So some people we met, they are working nearly the same amount of hours, but they feel better about it because they feel like they have control over where they work from, and because they feel like they have some control over what work they do if they're freelancing or entrepreneurs in a way that they didn't when they were in a corporate job. But many of them, they may be doing very similar work to what they did before, but now they feel autonomy because of their choice of location and environment and those kinds of things that they can control. At the same time, there are people who are downshifting and choosing to work significantly less hours, especially some of the people who were working very, very heavy hours before in their prior jobs. Many of them are working less hours now in Bali. And it should be said that many of them are making less income as well. So let's say, for example, you were working a job in London and you were making $100,000 a year. Pretty much all of that income was getting eaten up by your lifestyle. Now, suppose you move somewhere in Southeast Asia, Bali, Chiang Mai, whatever. Maybe you're making $35,000, $40,000 a year, even at least initially as a freelancer. That money, it seems like it's a lot less. But now if you think about the lifestyle, what you're paying for that there, it's so much less that you actually see people who have more money, more available money to travel, to do whatever it is that they want to do in their lives in their free time.
Do the countries where these digital nomads congregate, like Bali or Chiang Mai, Thailand, mm-hmm. do the countries like this?
That's a great question, because that's a big pushback question that we get, which is the exploitation, right, of the place, right? And because it's like a form of gentrification. On one hand, you know, Bali, their entire economy, or a very big segment of their economy, is tourism. Digital nomadism is a form of what we call work tourism. Now, the digital nomads don't like to think of themselves always as tourists, because they kind of think of themselves more as culturally immersed and sensitive to the place where they're going. They're long-term travelers. A tourist is like your stereotypical Bermuda shorts, sunburn person that goes someplace for a week and tries to squeeze everything in. And they think of themselves as sort of more sophisticated than that. So on one hand, it's just part of the tourism industry. On the other hand, the more tourists that go there, nomads included, that's the more plastic bottles that are not, you know, they don't have recycling there. They have minimal trash pickup. So and the water's not potable. So there's tons of pollution that comes with tourism. The cost of living goes up. And so people in those areas are very eager to sort of sell their rice fields or their rice paddies and their family to see if they can get like a big hotel developer or something to buy the land. And that, of course, changes the landscape and the culture if they lose their rice fields. Younger generations, and this is actually true, they don't want to work the rice paddy, or they don't want to work for their family. They want to work in the tourism industry, like giving bike tours and stuff like that. there is cultural conflict. For instance, we saw this all the time, like women and men riding on motorbikes in a bikini. And in Bali, even though it is very open-minded there, they are very conservative about how you dress. The women have their shoulders covered most of the time. They may smile at you and they don't want to confront, but it does bother them. And you can see it in forums where there are Balinese people talking about what they call boules, like the mainly white Westerners who are there and the way they're behaving and being disrespectful to the temples and things like that.
What is the type of digital nomad that was birthed by this pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think people now are using this term work from anywhere. That's really become, I mean, I have to sort of contextualize this. Like, you can't even imagine when before the pandemic, literally like a month before the pandemic, when Rob and I were talking to people about this project, people were like, remote work? Like, you mean on Fridays for half a day, like after you've been with the company for 20 years, like remote work was mainly seen as like something pretty marginal. And then, so people were like, what's a digital nomad? Like, what are you talking about? And then the pandemic hit and within like a month, all the workplaces had to change, you know, places where we couldn't possibly have files that are electronic, you know, all of a sudden they're electronic. It has been, a moment where people are sort of recognizing that lots of things could have been done this way. And I am choosing, not the disease part of it, but I'm choosing to view this as like something that needed to happen as we are falling behind in figuring out and being creative about things such as work-life balance, women and the reasons women leave the workplace because it's so confining to have to be at work till six. And, you know, especially when you're trying to have children and raise your children or even just pick up your children after school. School hours don't match work, traditional work hours. So there are a lot of ways that the workplace has sort of not been great for women. And this can be something that can free women to not have to take time off their career track and still be able to have flexibility to parent. Mm-hmm. And men too, it will equalize parenting if both men and women have access to this. I think now people realize anywhere sometimes is Bali, sometimes it's Starbucks, sometimes it's your closet or your bedroom. Many of us have jobs that we've taken and we don't necessarily like where we're living. But we have to do it because that's where the job was. But if you can do your job from anywhere, your constraints won't be the same. So let's say you want to be closer to family or your parents are ailing and you want to be closer to them.
And is there any way for this shift to happen without further creating the divide between the types of work that exist in the world where certain kinds of jobs that are often lower paid and less skilled and they have to be done on site, but you'll have, you know, the mid and upper level executive types who can get away with never showing their face in the office. What does that do you think, for both the class divisions and the kind of the workplace culture of America, Professor Litchfield?
First of all, we did learn in the pandemic that there were a lot more jobs that could be done remotely than we maybe thought there were 5 minutes before the pandemic. And those were not all high-level jobs, right? So even if you look in the digital nomad world, you'll see people who work as virtual assistants, right? It's kind of like an administrative type assistant kind of person, but it's just all done online. It's all done through electronic resources. And so, you know, these things can be done maybe for more jobs than we sometimes think. That said, of course, there are jobs that depend upon a physical presence. And in fact, there are also people who would prefer to be, you know, located in an office somewhere or doing that kind of work in that kind of way. And so part of this is about preferences, but in fact, there might be, you know, is there going to be a class divide that's exacerbated? Well, it doesn't seem like there's very much that happens these days that doesn't exacerbate a class divide. But I think that a lot of it will depend upon how these things are managed and about choices we make as a society that are maybe divorced or separate from the issue of simply whether or not work can be done remotely. Because, of course, at the same time, people are going to be worried, hey, when we start making people work remotely, is that going to make that work more transactional and turn those people maybe into more second-class citizens? So we focused on all the privileges of it. But on the other side of it, you know, there's the sense that, okay, if this work can really be done from anywhere, then, you know, how valuable are these people, right?
Except that to retain top talent, you're going to have to build in flexibility now because the game has changed. I mean, the top talent isn't going to accept the lack of trust in the workplace and the controllingness and the lack of dignity that comes with that in a digital native world. And so I think that it's going to be very hard to retain top talent at that level. And I also think a lot of people are starting to recognize some of the good things, even people who, let's say, are not skilled in computer related things. Look how people would prefer to be an Uber driver than like have other kinds of jobs because they want that flexibility. And maybe one thing that could happen is, like, I've heard many people during the pandemic have started their own businesses. Maybe they're a nail tech or something like that, and they can just go in a little van and go to people's houses and do their nails and stuff like that. There's all kinds of like little businesses like that that are taking off as people are starting to question, you know, do I want to be cleaning offices, you know, at night from this time to this time? Is there another way I can make at least, you know, $10 an hour? And that's where you're going to see wages go up too, because increasingly it's going to be hard to get people to do those kind of really rigid work environments with no flexibility. And so people from all classes are going to be looking for, you know, partial remote work as part of their lives as a way to make ends meet.
Rachel Waldoff is a professor of sociology at West Virginia University, and Robert Litchfield is a professor of business at Washington and Jefferson College. Together, they are authors of Digital Nomads, In Search of Freedom, Community, and Meaningful Work in the New Economy. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, a look at how labor unions in America came to embrace the cause of undocumented immigrants. With us for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Labor unions have been among the most active supporters of DACA. That's the program that allows undocumented immigrants to work in the United States if they came to the country as children. Unions helped get DACA implemented 9 years ago during the Obama administration. And now, as DACA's fate continues to be contested in the courts, unions are calling for Congress to create a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants living in the United States. But why are labor unions so squarely on the side of undocumented workers when, for most of the last century, unions held the opposite view? Early leaders of the labor movement in America saw foreign-born workers as a direct threat to the jobs of native-born Americans. The American Federation of Labor was a big supporter of the restrictive immigration laws Congress was passing in the late 1800s and early 1900s, barring immigrants from China and other countries. For this special episode of Top of Mind, marking Labor Day, we wanted to understand how unions came to be so squarely on the side of undocumented workers in America. Cornell University labor law expert Shannon Gleason says it boils down to two things: inevitability and survival.
What they essentially came to was, this is a reality of the workforce. It is a reality of capitalism, and it's a reality of the way in which we've structured inequality in our region. And these individuals are going to be here whether or not we choose to fight alongside them or not. So why not organize with them in order to raise all boats? This is seen demographically as a simple reality of what it means to address the issues of working people, and a tactical strategy, I would say, as the number of foreign-born individuals in this country continues to rise and the number of unauthorized workers continues to hold steady and is outsized, especially in certain industries where labor unions are especially concerned about dropping numbers.
The largest labor federation in the country, the AFL-CIO, made its support for undocumented immigrants official with a formal resolution it passed in the year 2000. Gleason explains.
In that resolution, what they talked about not only was the demographic reality, in the sense that increasingly the individuals who unions were trying to organize were foreign born and increasingly did not have access to work authorization. And so if we look at, even though nationally about 5% of the civilian workforce is undocumented, if we start to look at key industries where unions are active or attempting to be more active, unauthorized work is an inevitable part of that.
And like, so, such as the hospitality and service industry.
Hospitality and service, yes, with the trades. And I should say that the trade organizations, the National Building Trades Organization, which is a partner to the AFL-CIO, but it's a separate thing, has typically had a more centrist approach to this. But certainly in the trades, also, if we look at farm work, construction work, both residential and commercial, especially residential work, and I think all sorts of increasing manufacturing where the concern is that those jobs will be shipped overseas.
Now, this shift toward embracing immigrant rights had not been sudden or smooth. Historian Ignacio Garcia says Mexican-American immigrants in the early 1900s established themselves as effective organizers for their rights and for the needs of their communities, but they were not doing it inside the emerging labor movement.
Because many Mexican-Americans were not allowed to join the union, even the miners' union, which was very powerful for many years, did not allow Mexicans to participate. They had to do that. And they were very nationalistic organizations in the sense that they were for Mexican workers, because in that area they were dealing with, it was predominantly Mexican and Mexican-Americans. And so
Where was this? This would have been?
Mostly throughout the Southwest.
Okay.
And one of the things that we don't realize is that when the major unions were really taking a hit during the late 20s and early 30s before legislation came to help them, Mexican-Americans had a real heyday in terms of union activism and kept the union movement in the Southwest alive. They were striking, they were boycotting, they were organizing, again, not under a particular union, except maybe an organization that had to do with a mutual aid society or some group within the Mexican-American community. So this kind of labor activity was always there, and oftentimes it took the major unions time to catch up and to say, okay, these people really are involved. They really fight for workers' rights.
The labor movement in America had a big win in 1935 when FDR signed the National Labor Relations Act, which gave workers the right to organize and created the National Labor Relations Board to resolve disputes between workers and employers. But two large groups of workers were left out of those protections: domestic service workers and farm workers. Cornell's Shannon Gleason says the decision was rooted in racism.
Those used to be jobs that Black women and Black men typically filled. And as that became increasingly also a job for undocumented and other immigrant workers, the National Relations Act, when it was created, found that these were part of the private sphere and excluded those two industries from being organized.
That did not stop Black and immigrant workers who filled those positions from organizing themselves anyway. They used boycotts and strikes to demand better treatment. It just meant that they had fewer legal protections if employers retaliated against them.
But things were very difficult, and it was very hard.
Again, history professor Ignacio Garcia of Brigham Young University.
By the 1940s, when there is a tremendous need for farm workers, because so many Americans joined the armed forces, or opportunities open up in the defense department. So there's a lot of them that leave. And the Bracero program, which was that was what it was called, was an attempt. It was an agreement between the U.S. and Mexico in which large numbers of Mexican workers would come over. They would work. They were guaranteed a certain wage, which they never got. They were guaranteed housing, which was terrible. They were guaranteed health services, which were never given. And in some ways, what that does is it causes a real split within the Mexican-American community, because Mexican-American farm workers are now pushed up to the north. They cannot compete. So that if...
Oh, with the cheap bracero labor that's coming straight in from Mexico.
And which causes a really interesting political dilemma, because before the 1960s, many of the leaders, what we consider the leaders of the Mexican-American community, were against this kind of program, and they would, and sometimes they would become rather disturbed. They would become annoyed, and in fact, become very anti-Mexican, anti-undocumented, because undocumented,
these were Mexican Americans,
right,
who were against Mexicans coming to the United States, right, to work, either documented or otherwise.
And even Cesar Chavez initially. Now the union and everything has changed dramatically, but he used to take farm workers, the members of his union, and line them up in the bridges from Mexico, you know, crossover.
To try and stop undocumented folks from coming through.
And they fought.
Because they didn't want the competition for the field
work. That's right. Because what happened is once these people would come in, initially with the program, that was not supposed to be a problem. But what happens is a lot of agricultural businesses do not follow the rules. Or what happens is that more smaller independent farmers began to offer them money and began to offer these braceros that instead of going home when they were supposed to, why not stay and work for me?
Oh, just under the under the table, right, and we'll just keep you here.
And that sort of helped collapse the program, the bracero program eventually, and forced unions, eventually Cesar Chavez and his union were forced to begin to organize Mexican workers who were coming over because they realized they couldn't fight.
They couldn't keep them out.
They couldn't keep them out. So they thought, okay, well, let's start working with them and organizing them. Hmm. And so then the undocumented worker population becomes critical to the unionizing efforts among Mexican Americans.
By the 1980s and 90s, the nation's largest unions were starting to see immigrant workers as crucial to their success. And they saw undocumented immigrant workers as an untapped resource for their movement. So in the year 2000, the AFL-CIO endorsed amnesty for undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. And the union began wielding its political clout in support of comprehensive immigration reform, says Professor Gleason.
Certainly, they were playing a big role in terms of the internal compromises through the 2000s that we saw through kind of the gridlock of Congress, not being able to come to a congressional agreement, what was often referred to as comprehensive immigration reform. And in the absence of that, a number of different unions finally did come around to the demands largely of youth movement organizers who said, we're not going to get Congress to act on this, and we need your leadership and your support to help pressure the president to use his executive action powers to move something forward. And so that's where we got the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, what you refer to as DACA, and where we attempted to get a bigger program that would have encompassed individuals who were the parents of green card holders and citizens. And so once DACA was in place in the summer of 2012, unions, many of them, though not all of them, did step into place on two main fronts. One was to help individuals process their applications. And they did this through a number of different ways, either through a lot of resource and referral or dissemination of information to help connect people with resources. But also in some cases, as we saw in San Francisco, there was an attempt to partner with, in that case, municipal entities that were pouring money into immigration services and would provide actual what we might think of as case management. So it was both getting the information out and also connecting folks with legal services to help process their applications.
Since DACA targets young undocumented immigrants who are looking to go to college or start their careers with temporary protection from deportation, Gleason notes it's not a program that directly benefits labor unions. But the undocumented parents of DACA recipients are likely to be working in the industries where unions are actively organizing. Supporting DACA is a way of showing solidarity with those parents. But unions still face steep barriers in convincing those undocumented workers to start organizing, says Gleason.
What happened is that a case made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in 2002, it was decided, Chief Rehnquist was at the helm at the time, that undocumented workers did indeed continue to have rights under the National Labor Relations Act to organize, but they didn't have the same remedies if they were to be fired. And that creates a massive loophole, you can imagine, for unions who are engaged in organizing with undocumented workers. And so then, you know, we've seen this in many cases where, for example, here on Long Island, there was a cookie company. This has been all over the news, Tate's, which allegedly engaged in explicit retaliation against workers threatening to call immigration authorities if they continue to organize for a union. So we certainly have that where there are threats directly. And during the Trump administration, I think that that was a very valid threat that could have been acted upon. But I think that even now in the Biden administration, there's all sorts of ways that people can get caught up in the deportation pipeline, whether or not they are actively organizing or not. And so the kind of lay low mentality, I think, is something that both unauthorized workers and low wage workers who simply don't want to lose their job and have very little protections against losing their job, they want to engage in. And so we also see this in certain industries where it's really up to the employer who they want to hire, folks wanting to avoid getting blacklisted, being seen as rabble rousers. And so that is, I think, what the unions, if go back to your original question, you know, what is part of their calculus? It's both the demand on the part of members, but it's also as a labor movement to survive the current reality in which we live in, both economic and political, they have to be able to engage in this organizing work for all workers and to be assured that the rights of the undocumented will be respected just as any other low-wage worker. And that's a precarious hope, I think, at this stage.
That's Shannon Gleason, a professor of labor relations law and history at Cornell University. We also heard from Ignacio Garcia, a professor of Western and Latino history at Brigham Young University. And that's it for this special episode of the show Marking Labor Day. It's been great having you with us today. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Raymond produce the show. You can listen on demand by subscribing to our podcast. Just look for Top of Mind on your favorite podcast app to get new episodes daily. And our website is byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First this hour, the world's smallest computer could help unlock secrets of the natural world. Also, how healthy are shark populations today compared to thousands of years ago? Then, musicians are not worried about artificially intelligent computers replacing them. Rather, they are partnering with AI to write new music. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for joining us. When scientists want to understand the secret life of a species, like a turtle or a hawk or a whale, they'll often catch the animal and fit it with a transmitter to track its movement. But how do you put a tracker on a tiny snail or a butterfly? You need the world's smallest computer, which was co-invented by University of Michigan engineering professor David Blau, who joins us now. Professor Blau, hello. Thanks for your time.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
How tiny is your tiny computer?
It's about 2 by 1 by 3 millimeters.
Okay.
And that's after it's been encapsulated with epoxy to make it so that we can stick it on things.
So compared to the size of, say, a dime, how tiny would this be?
Oh, we once took a thimble, and I think we could stick several hundred of them in a single thimble.
In a thimble?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, these are very, very tiny then.
Yes, they are truly very tiny. We've lost many of them just in the lab. Yes.
But I can see it with the naked eye, so to speak.
Yes, you can see them.
Okay.
Yeah, without problem. But they're hard to handle. Yes.
Right. You need very, very good dexterity. When you put it on the shell of a snail, that's roughly the size of maybe like a garden snail. How big is it? Is it cumbersome to the snail at all?
Well, yeah, that was part of the reason that it had to be so small, because we did not want to interfere with the movement of the snail. Hmm. And so it's really, maybe around a fifth or a tenth of the size of the snail that we were studying. Our collaborators, who are biologists, felt that that was small enough not to impede their movement.
You said you encapsulated in some sort of epoxy, so to make it waterproof, or what's the point of that?
Yeah, that's to make it waterproof. So it actually has to be pretty rugged, which is also challenging. It's not only has to be small, but it has to withstand water. The snails actually move quite a bit and they bump against things. So it has to withstand all of that as well.
And how do you hook it onto the shell of a snail?
Yeah, we actually, so, you know, we're electrical engineers, so we always thought that, you know, attaching to the snail would be not a big problem. But actually, we did spend quite a bit of time figuring that out. And we tried different things. We tried Velcro, but that was too big. We tried magnets, but that wasn't strong enough. So finally, we found a tiny screw that's similar to the screws you use for your glasses, the frames of your glasses. And then we were able to glue one end of the screw to the sensor and the nut to the shell of the snail. And then we could basically screw it on. And then once we were done, we could unscrew it and take it back off.
Wow.
So that was the final solution.
So you had to do this, or somebody did, with live snails and like tweezers or something. I mean, to be able to handle this on such tiny scale.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah. And on many snails. So our students that went out to Tahiti to do this, they spent about 2 weeks instrumenting snails and taking measurements.
Now, explain for us, you're the computer guy, but explain for us what the researchers who were using your tiny computers were trying to figure out with these things on the backs of snails.
Yeah. So Tahiti is a very interesting place because there was a large number of different kinds of small snails that were also very culturally important to them. They were used in trading and as jewelry. And around 50 to 60 years ago, there was an introduction of a predatory snail. And, you know, as you say, we're computer science people, so, and computer engineering people. So we didn't realize this, but there are snails that eat other snails. There's snails that are carnivorous. And this newly introduced snail ate and then wiped out in a matter of a few years pretty much all the species of the snails in Tahiti. This was a really tremendous disaster for the ecology of that region. And what was interesting to the researchers was that there was a particular snail species that was surviving, in fact, doing pretty okay, and has continued to do pretty okay and survived in the presence of these predators for all these last 50 years. So the mystery was, why did all these 40-some species go extinct within a matter of years, few years, while this other one was able to survive?
And why did they need your tiny computer to help figure that out? Couldn't they just, you know, use cameras to like, record what was happening or like, you know, use just visual monitoring?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So their hypothesis was that the prey snail, the Tahitian snail, has a white shell. And so their hypothesis was that it was staying in areas that were more fully lit and more exposed to sunlight. Mm. And that the predator snail, the introduced foreign snail, is darker and therefore was avoiding those regions because snails are very sensitive to heat. Mm. And so they really needed to measure the light from the perspective of the snail. So like, in other words, as a snail, how much light are you getting exposed to? And the snails are moving. And so they really needed something that could be on the snail measuring the light continuously. And that's what our little computers were doing for them.
Okay. Now, why are you calling it a computer rather than just a sensor? I mean, tiny sensors have been around for a long time, and I have a tiny computer in my pocket, right? Like, what exactly is so special about this particular thing that you've developed that's different from all the other, you know, sensors out there that can measure light and measure, you know, lots of other things in an environment?
Yeah, so it's, well, we call it a computer, or we believe it's a computer, because it actually has a little processor on it, and so it can process the data. It can store the data, just like you can do on your cell phone.
It has a memory, like a hard drive?
It has a small memory that is like a hard drive, just like your cell phone.
Okay.
Your cell phone doesn't really have a hard drive anymore.
Just sends stuff to the cloud, yeah.
Yeah, well, and it's a static memory.
Okay.
But it has all the kind of functions that your cell phone would have, in the sense that it has an input device, which has our sensors, sensor inputs. It has a processor that can be programmed, store data, and it can radio out that data, so it can communicate that data out. It doesn't have a display or a keyboard.
Okay, so there is no keyboard. There's no monitor.
Correct. That's okay. Right. So all the input is through sensors. All the output is through radio. And that's necessary in order to make these computers this small. But otherwise, it has, you know, a power supply, battery. It actually harvests energy from light so that it can continue to operate. And it has ability to process the data. And that makes it very versatile so that we can program it to do different things in different settings, which was quite important in this case to be able to adapt it to the kind of measurements that we wanted to take.
Okay. So it's solar powered, but you were also, it has some sort of a solar sensor on it because you were trying to capture light readings on the backs of
these
snails.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We had to measure the light dose, if you want to call it that, the total accumulated light that each of the kinds of snails was being exposed to throughout the entire day. And that's the main result that we were able to produce with these tiny devices.
And what was the actual processing of the data that was happening in your tiny computer? Because couldn't it just take the reading and immediately radio it back to some master computer that would do the processing?
Yeah, so we had to do some processing on the chip, on the device, because we needed to compress it. And store it, and then later on, when instructed, radio out. These are so small; the radio only goes a very short distance, a few centimeters. Mm. So we had to actually later on retrieve the data, and it couldn't radio it out immediately.
Wait, so you had to? So the team had to go back and find the snails that they had put these things on, and then
that's correct.
And then take the computers off to harvest the data, or just like get up close enough that they could get a wireless reading?
Yeah, either way. Mm. Either way, yeah.
Okay.
I think in practice they took them off because they wanted to then reuse them later again.
Huh.
That's right.
Are they equipped also with some sort of GPS? How were they able to find these snails with the cameras on them? I mean, the computers.
Yeah, they would. So the prey snails, the Tahitian snails, actually didn't move very much. Because they, during the day, are actually hiding, and they're hiding in these places that are more heavily lit. But the predator snail does move a lot, and so they would kind of keep track of them, and they did lose a few here and there, and then sometimes later on found them again. And while they move a lot, because they're still snails, so they don't move that much, so they were able to kind of track them.
So, Professor Blau, what did your tiny computers help to reveal about the answer to this mystery?
Yeah, it was really... very exciting, because when we saw the data, the graph, it showed that the predator snail really stayed at much, much lower light levels than the prey snail. And so the Tahitian snail, the predator was, maybe around 5,000 lux or so at most, and even less. And the Tahitian snail would go up to many tens of thousands of lux, even 100,000 of lux. Mm. And so in some sense, the Tahitian snail has you can think of this sort of as a light wall around it that is a barrier that keeps the predator snail out.
Right.
And seeing that data for the first time and knowing that, you know, they had been looking for ways to obtain this data, and being able to see that data for the first time and know that this is data that we had never seen before and had never been able to obtain, because we've never had a device of this size that can take these readings. That was very both exciting and gratifying.
What other kinds of information could your tiny computers collect? Can they do video, audio, temperature readings?
Yeah, we can do temperature. In fact, we did temperature on the snails as well. Mm. We do have versions that can do video and audio as well. They're a little bigger. They're maybe around 5 millimeters in size. Yeah, it's harder, and we need a little bigger size, and they can radio out further. And we can also measure humidity, and we're working on being able to do locationing, where we can figure out within about 10 centimeters in a 1 mile range where they're located. And we're hoping to use that to study various kinds of insects like wasps and bees to understand better how they forage and how they fly around.
You could actually put this on a wasp or a bee. It's small enough for that.
Yes, yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it's small enough to go on a wasp or a bee.
Okay.
And we have a version that's we're right now putting on monarch butterflies.
Oh, tell us about that. Monarch butterflies. And they're so lightweight that weight would be a really issue, an important issue as well. It's just size.
That's exactly right. Yes. In fact, those devices are they have a slightly bigger antenna so that we can radio out about 100 meters. But the antenna is very thin. And so they're a little bigger, like about 5 millimeters, but they still weigh around 50 milligrams. So very light.
Where on the butterfly do you put this tiny computer?
It would be the equivalent of between our shoulders. So it's on the thorax, right behind the head. And so it's kind of like between their wings. So if they fold their wings all the way up, it's like right in between.
You can't use a screw in that case because it's like the monarch's body. So how are you getting it on there?
Actually, we just use super glue. Yes. Oh,
okay.
We just glued them on. And that's, again, we're working with a biologist who has studied all of that and figured out the best way to do that. But in the end, it was just super glue.
And what information are you hoping to capture from monarch butterflies?
From them, we're hoping, and we haven't done this yet, is to determine their location every day so that we can track them as they migrate from the northern United States and southern Canadian regions to Mexico each year, which is something that we know very little about. And if we could see their trajectory, we could learn a lot about where they are, how they travel, how they know how to find these regions in Mexico. Where they overwinter, and also help preserve them.
So these are location. It's the location monitoring that you're especially interested in here. Then is it through GPS? Is it like communicating with a satellite, or how is it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So no, we cannot do GPS. That's too power hungry. We don't have the power for that and the size. What we do is we actually measure temperature and we measure very precisely the light level and the time. And by figuring out the sunset and sunrise and knowing the day, we can figure out our latitude and longitude. And we actually use a lot of artificial intelligence post-processing that we do after we retrieve the data to get the location of the butterfly. It's not as accurate as GPS, but we can get within tens of kilometers is our belief.
Okay. That's pretty ingenious. What other kinds of biologists and ecologists, what other kinds of research do you think this could be useful for?
Well, we're looking at wasps, and then we're also looking at other applications actually outside of insects. Okay. We have some research to implant these inside tumors to measure pressure.
A cancer tumor in a person.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Although, of course, initially it will be inside animal models of tumors.
To measure pressure?
Yes, because pressure is a indicator of the health of the tumor. And so that would allow us to, and then it would radio it out. That would allow us to understand sort of on a daily basis how the tumor is responding to various treatments, such as chemotherapy. Whereas right now that is done over a much longer interval. You go through your whole chemo and then they will do an MRI of some kind or a PET scan and then see if it was effective or not. Yeah. So this could help prevent having to go through as much chemo if it's not effective or give the doctor more chance to readjust the medication.
There must be all kinds of potential medical uses for a tiny, tiny little sensor with a processor like this.
Yeah, there is. We're also working on measuring pressure inside the eye for glaucoma, and there's a lot of interest in that. They're very challenging because, of course, they have to be safe, and they're very small, and they have to be reliable. So there's plenty of challenges there, but there's also a lot of opportunities.
David Blau is a professor of electrical and engineering and computer science at the University of Michigan, one of the co-inventors of the world's tiniest computer. Thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, can an artificially intelligent system write a song as well as a human musician can write a song? Just ahead, how an ecologist gathered and sorted tiny fossils of shark scales to gauge the health of prehistoric shark populations. This is Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Julie Rose. Ever since humans came on the scene, shark populations along coastlines have been declining. So it's hard for scientists to know where to set conservation goals. We don't really know what a healthy shark population was several thousand years ago, because humans only started keeping count about 100 years ago. UC Santa Barbara ecologist Aaron Dillon landed on a cool but painstaking way to estimate how many sharks might have been hanging around a coral reef 7,000 years ago. Professor Dillon is on the line. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
If we could talk for a moment about the reason for this research, why is it helpful to know how many sharks were around before humans? That's so long ago. That how could that information actually be relevant to current conservation activities?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess to take a step back, sharks play really important roles on coral reefs and in other marine ecosystems. So they're part of a really healthy ecosystem and a healthy ocean. And so it's important to then understand how many sharks there were on coral reefs or in the ocean before humans to give us a sense of what was natural for their populations. What roles were they playing? What's kind of a realistic and healthy, what does a healthy ecosystem look like?
Mm. But it wouldn't be realistic for us to say we need to try to bring shark levels back to where they were 7,000 years ago at this particular reef.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's important to have those historical baselines to understand kind of where our ecosystems were. So the roots of the communities that we see on coral reefs today, even though, I mean, humans are in the picture. So we need to think about human ocean relationships and sort of what's realistic moving forward. But at the same time, it's important to know and have that historical context.
Right. Kind of just to know the possibilities. Like,
exactly.
You know, here's what it really could be like. Of course, it can't be. But, you know, here's the range we could think about. So describe the reef that you're studying.
Yeah, so we were first exploring this technique on a reef along the Caribbean coast of Panama in a place called Bocas del Toro. And it's situated pretty close to the border with Costa Rica. And it's a really unique area in that it's this sheltered lagoonal system. You have kind of small, bright, colorful towns intermingled with these reefs, mangroves, and seagrass ecosystems.
So it's an actual reef currently underwater that you're studying?
It is. Okay. Yeah. So I guess to clarify, we looked at both modern reefs, so underwater on snorkel or scuba. Okay. But then we also had this unique opportunity to look at the fossil reef.
Okay. So to compare the two. And the one you just described is the underwater one. And it, would you describe it, you called it Boca, what was the name of the place?
Bocas del Toro.
Okay. And is it a fairly healthy reef, the one, the modern reef you're looking at?
Not so much. It's definitely transformed a lot over the last hundreds of years with human influence. So what you're seeing today when you go diving is not a particularly healthy reef.
Okay. But there are sharks there at the reef?
There are some, yes. I personally have never seen one, but they are there. There's been some recent monitoring efforts, and there are sharks on the reefs today.
Okay. And what kind of sharks hang out at a reef near the coastline?
So in this particular region, today you see a lot of nurse sharks. So that's a species of shark that is fairly demersal. It hangs out kind of near the benthos, the bottom of the reef, kind of thick skin, kind of large, lethargic sort of shark. But you also see a mixture of other species. So there's some hammerheads, Caribbean reef sharks.
Okay.
And that's, yeah.
And they hang out at reefs because they feed on fish or I don't know, whatever else lives at the reef?
Yeah, so reefs are a big source of food. You have some sharks that have what's called high site fidelity. So they're mostly hanging out at a certain reef or kind of a collection of reefs. And then you have some that'll migrate and move a lot farther between reef sites along the coast.
Okay. And then you studied a fossilized reef. Is that also underwater?
So it is technically below sea level, but it's actually on dry land. So when we were sampling it, we were not in snorkel gear, but in, you know, shoes and normal clothing. So it was actually exposed during a construction project at the site. Because normally, if you think of a reef, the fossil reef would be below the modern reef since they're sort of accreting upwards. And so they're burying their history. Mm. But in this case, we had this really spectacular opportunity to see and collect very large samples at this 7,000-year-old reef site.
Okay, so 7,000 years ago, this particular reef was underwater. Today, it's not because of changing sea levels, I guess. And there was a bunch of dirt on top of it, but then some development happened. And in the excavation, they discovered this fossilized reef that dates back 7,000 years. And it's also in Panama?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's right adjacent to the modern reef. So if you can literally step off the fossil reef and be on a modern living reef.
Wow, that's cool. What does a fossil reef look like?
Yeah. So in this particular case, you see a lot of reef frameworks. So sort of like intertwined fingers of coral mixed with sediment and kind of layers upon layers of this coral matrix. So if you dig down into the reef, you just see a wall of tiny sediment particles. You see some larger coral heads and then sort of these branching coral fingers.
And do sharks have a lot of bones that can be fossilized? Like how do you know if sharks were there?
No, it's a good question because sharks are largely cartilaginous. And when you think of the fossil record of a shark, you probably think about teeth. Mm. And so teeth are far, I guess, better studied. But sharks also have other parts that will fossilize. So their vertebrae can fossilize. You can even find fossilized shark poop. Hmm. But in our case, we looked at the tiny scales of sharks, which are essentially tiny teeth.
Sharks have scales? Like covering their body?
They do, yes.
Oh, okay. Huh, but they don't look like fish scales. They're different, I guess.
Yeah, so they look a little bit different. So I guess like if you've ever kind of touched a shark at an aquarium touch tank, the skin is sort of rough like sandpaper in one direction and smooth in the other.
Okay.
Some of these technology or some shark scales have even been used to sort of inspire technologies like shark skin swimsuits.
Mm. Okay, so these scales so the ones that you're discovering then they've been fossilized as just actual scale. You can see the whole scale, which is how large would one of those scales be?
Yeah, so they're like a couple strands of hair across.
Oh,
for comparison.
Very tiny.
Like finding a needle in a haystack.
Right. So how do you find them in a basically an archaeological dig?
Yeah, so in this case we were collecting large bulk samples, we call them, of sediments. So think of they're about, I guess, 10 kilos per sample. In total, it was about enough sand to fill two bathtubs.
Wow. You're just shoveling up sand from this.
Essentially.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So the trick then is vinegar. Mm. So because the sand on a coral reef is largely made of bits of coral, we can actually digest those away using vinegar. And that makes it possible to actually find these tiny scales.
Hmm. And are these shark scales left over from sharks that like died on the reef?
Not necessarily. So sharks shed their scales continuously as they're swimming. So in most cases, I think a lot of the scales we find were just shed by sharks that were either living on the reef or sort of transiting through the reef.
And what can you learn from looking at a shark scale?
Yeah. So before we could really kind of do this study, we needed to take a step back and understand exactly that question of like, if we find a scale, how does that relate to the ecology or the abundance of a shark? And so we built this massive reference collection from museum collections, measured different characteristics of the denticles and related those to shark ecology. And roughly what we found, and this has been kind of found by others as well, is that you can look at the kind of the shape and the form of the denticle. And
the
that can
denticle,
tell you,
denticle is the scale.
Denticle is a scale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So denticle is a scale. Look at the form of these scales and you can relate it to the ecology of the shark. So was it like a fast swimming shark that could reach really like fast burst speeds to catch its prey? Or maybe it was a demersal shark like the nurse shark that I mentioned before. And those have different looking scales.
Mm. Okay. But they're so tiny. How did you sort them?
Very, very carefully under a microscope using a paintbrush.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
How long did that take you to get through two bathtubs full of stuff?
Oh, a lot of time. It's worth it because otherwise this is information that we wouldn't have. But it's very painstaking. But yes.
And so what information is so important that we wouldn't have?
Yeah, so I guess without this fossil reef site, without these scales, we wouldn't have a very good idea, I guess going back to your original question, of what's natural for these reefs in Caribbean Panama when human influence was really low or non-existent. It would be data that we otherwise just couldn't really access.
If you could take us back 7,000 years to this reef as it was then, what would we have seen? What kinds of sharks? What would they be doing?
Yeah, so if you were to go snorkeling on this reef 7,000 years ago, not only would sharks have been a more common sight, but there would have been relatively more kind of fast-swimming pelagic sharks. So think of like a hammerhead or a recreum, kind of your classic reef shark. Whereas nurse sharks, so again, those demersal species, are much more common today than they were historically. So not only were abundances different, but the just types of sharks on these reefs were different.
Why would the fast swimming sharks have been so common back then, but they're so uncommon today around a reef like this?
Yeah, so those species are also targeted by humans, by fishing in particular. So we looked at middens, essentially old garbage piles, essentially for humans, that give us a sense of what they were eating in the past. And there were some shark teeth, and all of the teeth that were in those archaeological sites belong to these species that we don't see a lot of today. And the same trend holds true.
Meaning they were fishing, they were somehow either fishing them to eat or for their teeth or their whatever, their skin, like they were intentionally targeting the fast swimming sharks.
Exactly. And the same is true today, where a lot of the catch in Panama and elsewhere tends to be these faster swimming species.
Now, counting these scales from 7,000 years ago gave you this moment in time picture snapshot. Is that right? Do you have any sense, like, has it been a steady decline in the shark population over the last 7,000 years? Or, you know, was there a moment where it really dropped off, do you think?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. So this technique that we used at this particular site did give us this then versus now comparison. So what were sharks doing 7,000 years ago, and then what were they doing today? And both of those samples are what's called time average. So there's sort of a mixture of different ages in those samples. So we know that overall between those two periods, there were about three times more sharks in the past. But to get to your question, we needed to basically look at different data sources because we didn't have samples that sort of span that whole time period. So we integrated different historical sources, ecological sources, and different narratives to try to get a sense of, exactly that question. Was it a steady decline or was it sort of a sudden threshold? And what we found was, I mean, I guess unsurprisingly, that the largest decline occurred in the latter half of the 20th century. So that's a time period where there was a lot of human activity in that area. There were targeted fisheries and fishing really ramped up. And that seemed to coincide with a loss of sharks.
And is it only the fast swimming sharks that are coveted from fishing that have seen the decline?
So that's the other kind of interesting part. So those are the species that are most fished. And so if you look at the fish market, let's say in the area, you will mostly see these faster swimming species. However, we saw declines in these scales across all shark types. So not only did these fast swimming species decline, but we also saw declines in nurse sharks. And that we're thinking can be attributed to habitat change or reductions in prey in the area. Mm. So it wasn't just fishing to blame. It seemed like it's a kind of a combination of factors.
Factors often driven by humans, whether it's pollution or development or things that have changed the kind of prey that are at these corals.
Exactly. Mm.
Aaron Dillon is an ecologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thanks for taking time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, musicians are not worried about artificially intelligent computers replacing them because they're partnering with AI to write new music. They've got new songwriting partners.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. The song you're listening to is called Listen to Your Body Choir by Emojized, and it was the winner of the 2021 AI Song Contest. Yes, that's a real competition. 38 teams from around the world entered the contest with music that was composed and created with the help of artificial intelligence. Henrik Vincent Koops is a co-organizer and judge of the AI Song Contest, as well as an artificial intelligence researcher and composer. He joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how was AI used to create the song that we just heard?
Well, it was used in different ways and also for different parts of the music. So usually what happens is that you can't really generate a whole song with one computer program, let's say. So you have to break it down into different aspects. So for example, melody, lyrics, chords, so like harmony, and drums, and you create separate computer programs or models for those, and you generate music with those for those parts, and then afterwards you combine it. So in this case, this song, this team took inspiration from a very old computer generated song. This is a Daisy Bell. This was created in 1961 by IBM. It was actually sung by an IBM computer. And they took that as an inspiration. And they basically built on top of that. So they took the lyrics as inspiration and used that sort of as a seed in their model to create new lyrics. But also the melody is based on that, and also the chords. So it's... it's new, it's generated by AI, but it has deep roots in computer music.
And here's another little bit of it, that you can hear the human voice and then that computer sounding voice. Why was this song the winner of the contest this year?
Because there was a lot of things came together in this submission. So there's a really strong link with the history of computer music, which is very interesting to take that as a starting point. But then the team basically used AI in very interesting ways for all these aspects in their music. So for lyric generation, for melodies, for chords. And they assembled it also in a very interesting way, in where they, instead of creating a model or a computer program to create some music and just taking that as it is and putting it in your song, they actually created a sort of feedback loop where they took the output of the models, changed and curated the output, and then picked what they liked, and then fed it back to the model, and basically created a sort of back and forth with the AI, and really saw it as another part of the band, basically a member of the band, instead of just as a tool to just generate some stuff.
Earlier you said that you can't just use AI to create a song entirely. Why can't you? Why do you have to break it down, like you said, for just different parts, that you can kind of pick a little bit of AI here, a little bit of AI there?
Well, songwriting is a very difficult thing to do. It's hard for humans, but it's also very hard for computers. One thing that AI is struggling with right now is long-term structure. So it's very hard to generate something that has like the internal structure of a good pop song. So a verse and a chorus, and then a variation of that verse and a variation of that chorus, and then another variation, and then a verse and a chorus again. That kind of structure, the global structure, but then also like an interesting structure within the verse and the choruses. That's very hard to do, like very hard to create with AI right now. Like AI cannot look that far into the future when you're generating something. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is that you need to generate all these things at the same time and in a way that they make sense. And with these things, I mean, you need to create a good melody. You need to create good chords that go with it. You need to create good drums to go with it. And you need to create lyrics that make sense to go with it. And combining that all like in a good way to create a meaningful pop song is very hard.
So the computer can come up with a melody. It can come up with some lyrics. It can come up with, I don't know, whatever instrument, something else. And it can do all those things separately. But making something cohesive, putting those elements together, it just, that's too much for it. It can't make it work together.
It can do it to some degree, but it definitely needs human intervention. And I think that's a good thing. I think that makes it interesting. And that's also why I think the AI song contest is interesting, because that means that you need to have interaction between a computer and a human. We can learn something from the computer as it generates something. You could take that as an inspiration, whatever it creates. It can come up with very interesting new things that you couldn't have thought of yourself.
Can you give an example of something that a computer could come up with that you wouldn't come up with yourself?
Oh, that's interesting, because if I could, then I already, and like I would negate the question, I guess.
That's true. Okay.
So what a computer is good at is when you take a whole data set, so that means like a collection of music, it can analyze it and try to find patterns that are shared within the whole data set. And then afterwards, you can use that information to generate new melodies, for example. But the way the computer finds out that that data set is related, like all those songs are related to each other, might be different than how humans listen to the music. And then add a little bit of noise or a little bit of randomness to a computer model, and it creates something interesting that you couldn't have come up with, or it can combine things that you didn't think of yourself.
So in a way, a computer, I mean, it thinks differently than us. It's analyzing zeros and ones and all of that, and it just sees things that we don't see.
Yeah, that's an advantage and a disadvantage. So the advantage is that you can use it as sort of like an inspiration machine, right? But on the other hand, a computer just tries to solve a difficult problem, right? And it will try to find the road of least resistance to get there. So to say something meaningful about a data set with all kinds of songs, it might come up with basically a representation of that music that's meaningful for the computer, but not necessarily meaningful for humans. So I think if you take it to the extreme, you could, of course, get computers to generate music. But it will ultimately just generate music for itself if you don't take humans in the loop, right? So it will start to generate music for computers, which probably isn't very interesting for humans. So you constantly need to tell the computer, no, this is what humans want to hear, and this is what humans like. So you really need to constantly take the computer by the hand and make sure that he does what humans want it to do.
If it's so much work to teach a computer what humans like, what's the point other than getting some new ideas? why do this whole contest and really promote, you know, the AI human interaction to create music?
So there are different answers. So one is that we think that AI could be or is a new way of making music, and can be like a technology that basically will be the starting point of new genres and new types of music. The same way as you, when the electric guitar was invented, before the electric guitar, there were a lot of genres and types of music that were centered around the acoustic guitar. And when the electric guitar was invented, all kinds of new musical genres were invented, like metal, rock music, all kinds of like super tiny subgenres or bigger genres. And all those things couldn't have existed with the invention of the electric guitar, that technology. And we think that AI could be that kind of technology as well, where we can come up with new ways of creating music, new ways of being creative, and new ways of songwriting that makes it possible to find new creative spaces that we didn't know existed before.
I'm speaking with Henrik Vincent Koops. He's co-organizer and judge of the AI Song Contest, as well as an artificial intelligence researcher and composer. Let's listen to a little bit of another entry. This one's called Han by the group Han. But before we listen to it, could you give us a little bit of background on what we're going to hear?
This is a very interesting submission to the AI Song Contest because it deals with a very specific an emotion that's very typical for Korean culture. It's called Han. I don't know that much about it, but they what this team tried to do is model, so basically try to have a computer program understand that emotion and try to generate music with that particular emotion in mind so that it captured that emotion while generating music.
It does evoke emotion as you're listening mm-hmm. to it. That's a little scary, isn't it? That they used a computer to help them create emotion in song?
In a way, I think this is what people usually feel as, maybe a little bit scary because it really shows, we feel like in emotion or like emotion in music is really something human. And of course it is, but computers can actually model and recognize emotions in different ways. For example, emotional faces is something that computer models are pretty okay at. And also in music, you can make computer programs that can recognize if a part of a music is happy, for example, or one part is sad. And if you can identify that, then a computer model can also generate it with that emotion in mind.
Okay. Yeah. So it's just algorithms. It's recognizing patterns.
Yes. Yes. So particular emotions correlate. So they appear a lot with particular melodies or particular harmonic structures like chords.
Or like minor key is usually sad.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's in Western music. So, but in Korean music, this Han emotion also has particular qualities that correlate with particular melodies or particular chords, particular rhythms, and that's what they try to model here, and that's what they try to generate. So I think that's super interesting that the AI contest is not just focused on Europe or Western music, but it's this year we were all over the world. And this is a really good example of this cultural diversity in AI music.
Are you worried that AI could eventually replace music artists and composers? That, I mean, if it can recognize emotion, do you think eventually the technology would just get better and better until we don't need composers anymore? We don't need artists anymore?
I think to a certain degree, yes. So I think these types of programs will become better and better. But I also think that it's also always inherently more interesting to listen to a piece or a song or whatever that's composed by a human composer. Part of that is because we don't just like the music. So not just for its technical qualities, like is it like these type of melodies or these chords or... But we like also the story behind it. So the songwriter, we like Bob Dylan's music because Bob Dylan wrote it as well. We like Mozart's music because Mozart wrote it. Right. And the second thing is that humans will always, I think, like making music. So I don't think that at some point there will be algorithms that are so good that they will replace humans and humanity thinks, computers can do it better than us. Let's just not make music anymore. because people enjoy making music. They enjoy playing instruments. They enjoy making music together. So in that sense, I don't think algorithms will really replace humans. What I do think they will replace us at is, I think they will become very good at generating like background music in a style that you really like. So if a computer program knows your listening history, for example, on a streaming service, for example, it can learn what you like, maybe with some extra input from you, and then start to generate music in that same style with the same kind of instruments or same kind of melodies. And I can imagine that in the future, you can listen to sort of a radio that's AI generated.
How weird.
Yeah, but at the same time, this is also sort of like elevator music, right? So this is, I don't think this will ever become like to a quality or to like a cultural significance that a human composer will have.
Are there any ethical questions that come along with this, using artificial intelligence to create music?
We briefly touched upon it with the emotion side of it, but there's also a very interesting side of, for example, using data sets and using how can you generate something? Who owns it? If you train an AI on the models with data that has copyright, for example, who owns the songs? We had some interesting feedback last year of teams, for example. They thought that the songs that they created, the ownership, that they were not completely the owner of the songs, for example. They thought that the people who wrote the AI, the software, that they were part of the owners as well, which is kind of strange, because it would kind of mean that, for example, if a song is written on a Fender guitar, that Fender would have sort of like rights to the songs that are written on that guitar, for example. Very, very strange, but also very uncharted legal territory. Really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And the comparison between the guitar, like, yeah, does the person who made the guitar, do they have some rights to the song that was written on that guitar?
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Huh. And going along with this relationship between humans and AI and how you're hoping it'll be this symbiotic relationship working together, the song that audience members liked the most from the competition is called I Feel the Wires by Aimcat. And it's about a human and an AI talking to each other and coming to an understanding of each other. So here's a little bit of that. Henrik Vincent Koops is a co-organizer and judge of the AI Song Contest, as well as an AI researcher and composer. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
I know your heart is overrated. You've been hurt too many times.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. It's been great having you along today. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. We had technical support today from Martha Harris. Our website is byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.